Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and my goal is to help members of the armed forces and military veterans navigate their civilian career. Today's episode number 188 with Dr. Robert Glover.
And I know whenever I tell a nice guy that, you know, they need to put themselves first and start making their needs a priority, you know, when they get that deer in the headlight looks and the butt pucker, like, holy shit, that will make me a bad person.
Well, today we're deviating from the normal format for the show. Typically on the show, I have military veterans who talk about their civilian career, what they do, how they got there, and advice for other veterans pursuing that career path. Today, instead, I'm having on an author, Dr. Robert Glover, to talk about his book, No More Mr. Nice Guy. I'll get into the reason why in the recording here in a second, but I do think that Dr. Glover in this interview speaks to a couple pain points that have been articulated by many of my guests on the show. Quick note on the show notes at beyondtheuniform.io. Audible is offering a free audiobook of your choice to Beyond the Uniform listeners. If you enjoy this interview, I would encourage you, use that link. You can actually get Dr. Glover's book on audiobook for free, and Beyond the Uniform gets $15 to help with the production cost of the show. If you do enjoy this interview, let me know. I'll try to do more like that. Otherwise, I'll be back next week with our traditional format. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Dr. Robert Glover. Well, joining me today in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, is Dr. Robert Glover. Dr. Glover, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. And most people just call it PV. It's simpler.
Well, I want to give listeners your bio and then a little bit of context for our discussion. So first, an abbreviated bio. Dr. Robert Glover is the author of the book No More Mr. Nice Guy, A Proven Plan for Getting What You Want in Love, Sex, and Life. The New York Times has called him a, quote, psychology guru. In his 30-plus year career, he has worked with men in one-on-one therapy, group environments, online courses, podcasts, and more. Dr. Glover has changed the lives of countless men and women around the world. As a result of his work, Dr. Glover has helped thousands of nice guys transform from being passive, resentful victims to empowered, integrated males. Along with these personal changes have come similar transformations in these men's professional careers and intimate relationships. And so just to add on to that, so today is different than my normal interview for those of you who have listened to a lot of Beyond the Uniform, and I wanted to give some added context. Normally on the show, I chat with military veterans. We talk about their career, how they got there, and advice for other veterans seeking to do the same. And occasionally, I have on guests on the show who are not veterans, but whose work or advice would be helpful to the Beyond the Uniform audience. Quick side note, Dr. Glover's son served in the Marines. So he does have that connection to the military. So here's the added context. Dr. Glover wrote that book that I mentioned, No More Mr. Nice Guy. He and I attended a men's embodiment workshop taught by John Wineland, and his book was recommended to me by a friend when I was there. To give you a sense of how much I enjoyed this book, I have listened to the audiobook twice. I've bought the paper book. It is the only book I've read, listened to maybe over 100 audiobooks. It is the only book that I've ever had the audiobook and the physical copy of. I just wrapped up an 8-week group that was meeting online by video conference every single week to discuss Robert's book. And I'm starting in 2 weeks a group here in Denver every single week for an hour and a half to build on Robert's work. So to say the least, I am a big fan of the work that Robert is doing. The reason why I invited him on the show was, first of all, I think this interview could have a massive impact on some of you listening right now, because either you are a nice guy, you are in a relationship with a nice guy, you are parenting a nice guy, or you have some other relationship with a nice guy. But second of all, For those of you who are not nice guys, or what Robert identifies as nice guys, in the 180 interviews I've done so far, I've seen some trends in behavior with the veteran community, and a lot of them match with what Robert identifies as, quote, nice guy behavior. So we're going to dive into a couple of these topics so that it can benefit everyone, not just the nice guy listeners. So, Robert, maybe to start things off, how would you describe who or what a nice guy is?
Well, Justin, a nice guy, to kind of put it in a nutshell, is we're mainly talking, we'll direct this at men, but I know you have women in your audience as well. But primarily, I work with men. A nice guy is a person who doesn't believe they're okay just as they are. Now, this is true for a lot of us, and a lot of us as children internalize belief systems based on an inaccurate interpretation of our experiences when we're very young into a view of ourselves and a view of the world. And a lot of us have this sense that I'm not okay just as I am. And then we deal with it in various ways. The nice guy developed a way of dealing with it, a paradigm, a roadmap that says if I can just become what I think other people want me to be, then I'll be liked and loved and get my needs met. And if I can just hide or eliminate anything about myself that tends to create a negative reaction in others, then I'll have this smooth, problem-free life. And then this paradigm, as I said, was internalized often at a very young age, maybe beginning at a few months or a few years old, developed in a very immature mind, but then we try to apply it throughout our life as we get older. And now we're more powerful, we have more options, we have more control over our life, but we still tend to bring that sense of helplessness and not okayness with us into our adult life, and then apply these survival mechanisms that we learned at a very young age into our adult circumstances, and often it doesn't work very well.
It's one of the things I appreciated at the start of your book is you really show how reasonable it is that a child would be confronted with different circumstances or a different environment and choose this behavior to adapt and to survive. It's a perfectly reasonable human response for a child. But then when you think of how myself or other people take these strategies from childhood and still live with them, often unconsciously, it almost seems comical were it not so tragic to see how this is impacting people.
And you've nailed it. And that really what's happening is that when we're a little child, a few months old, when we're born, the only part of our brain that is fully online and fully functioning is part of the limbic system that has the amygdala. And most military people know about the whole fight, flight, freeze mechanism of where you're under extreme stress in a very helpless situation, and is a major contributor, we believe at least, to PTSD. And a lot of us, even if we've never been in a military zone, have PTSD from childhood, but we don't typically call it that. So what happens is because the only part of our brain really 100% online at birth is the part about survival, the part that enables us to keep breathing, our heart to keep beating, and for us to fight, flee, or freeze in the face of danger. All of our early experiences get stored up in that part of the brain. Now, that part of the brain doesn't store language. Language is online before language develops. It stores it as emotional memory. Now, that part of our brain, the amygdala, is no bigger than your fingernail on your little finger, but yet it is wired into every other part of our brain. Now, in males, the reasoning part of our brain doesn't fully finish developing until about 25 years old. That's why our car insurance goes down at 25. Not because insurance companies knew a lot about brain development, but they knew that males quit doing as many stupid things. They quit getting as many accidents and speeding tickets at about age 25. So the reasoning part of the brain isn't completely online till 25, but it is being driven by the amygdala. It's wired into every other part of the brain. And this is an opinion, as an aside, is probably a good reason not to send men under age 25 into a war zone. Their reasoning part of the brain is not completely developed, but the fight, flight, freeze part is highly activated. And so what happens is that part of our brain continues to influence every decision we make, even into our adult years. And we believe all of our perceptions about the world based on those very early internalized memory states are all 100% accurate, because we all believe everything our minds tell us to be true. And so if we think women aren't attracted to me, or if I think I'm never going to be a success, or, you know, if I think I'm stupid, we are going to believe that to be true. And we'll typically go find a lot of evidence to support those belief systems.
And so, you know, on the surface, you know, I think we all know someone we would consider a nice guy or nice person. But it's like, look, oh, this, he's such a nice guy. He always helps people out. He's always available. Oh, you're such a great guy. What is the downside of being a nice guy?
And that's such a good question, because that's where everybody always goes. Well, and it's where I went. If you'd met me 30 years ago, I would have told you I'm a nice guy. You know, I'm one of the nicest guys I know. And I would have thought that was a good thing. And I'm still a very generous, open, caring person. But the nice guy is driven by by three covert contracts. And I think this is maybe one of the core pieces in the book. It's what a lot of people really resonate with. And the three covert contracts are all a part of a if-then proposition between the nice guy and the world and the people in it. Covert contract number one, if I'm a good guy, then I will be liked and loved and get my needs met. Number two, if I meet everybody else's needs without them having to ask, then they will meet my needs without me having to ask. And covert contract number three, if I do everything right, then I will have a smooth, problem-free world. Now, the problem with the covert contracts is the nice guy usually is not conscious of them. He may be. He may be thinking, well, you know, if I'm nice to everybody, then I'll get a girlfriend, and then people will like me, or then I'll get a promotion, or then nothing will go wrong. If I can just follow all the rules, I'll have this smooth life. Nobody will get mad at me. You know, I won't get called out. I won't miss on opportunities. And then especially the part about needs. If I can meet everybody else's needs without them having to ask, then they'll meet my needs. But the problem with that is nobody else knows what our needs are. And we're often not very good at telling people or letting them know what our needs are. In fact, nice guys are terrible receivers in general. We feel guilty for having needs. We think we're doing something wrong. We feel indebted if other people want to do something for us. And so not only do we not only give to ourselves very well, we make it difficult for other people to give to us. So these covert contracts lead to all kinds of problems. Of the trying to become what we think people want us to be, hiding our flaws, our mistakes, our fuck-ups, being indirect, trying to be perfectionistic and get everything right. That can lead to procrastination, to avoidance. Nice guys often are really good at being good, but not great at being great. And the real core issue that really comes out a lot, and I talk about this early on in the book, is the emotional part that builds up in the nice guy when the covert contracts don't work. We think we've done our side of the contract, but the world or the people in our world haven't kept their side. So nice guys often can be often anything but nice. We can have resentments. We can be amazingly passive aggressive. We can let things build until we have a victim puke, as my ex-wife used to call them, where everything just comes puking out, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's not very pretty. And fundamentally, nice guys aren't particularly honest. You know, you would think honesty would be really a core virtue of a truly nice person. But if we're trying to get everybody's approval and trying to avoid their disapproval, we're not honest. We're not honest about what we think, what we feel, what we want, what we've done, where we're going, what we want to do, what we expect of others. And people usually find this out pretty indirectly or by accident.
It's so great. I'm just remembering, you know, the first two times I read your book, if not all three, the extreme discomfort I felt reading the, you know, what you just said, but you go into a lot more detail in the book. And it just felt like being exposed and seen in a way where I'd never seen myself. And I love, you know, when you talked about those covert contract, I can relate, and maybe listeners can as well. I can relate to that sense of like, wow, I'm always taking care of others. there was this unspoken agreement that they would then in some way repay me. And so always having in work and professional settings, but also in personal relationships, a lot of resentment building up of like, man, I'm doing so much for other people. Why aren't they repaying this? And meanwhile, I learned I never articulated that expectation to them, nor did I ever take time to figure out what I really wanted or needed. And like you said, chances are, had they given something to me in return, I would have been pretty shitty at receiving it. I wouldn't have been that open to receiving it. And I also really resonate with that other covert contract you said about rules. And I imagine a lot of us in the military were used to rules, but it's this... Again, it's not something I was aware of until you said it in your book, but it's like, wow, I really do have so many, so much belief that there are some set of rules in the world, and if I just figure them out and follow them, everything will work out. And it led to so much resentment of, oh, I thought I was doing everything right. Why isn't everything going my way? And so I love that. I love those covert contracts you said. And then also that honesty piece. Because again, I'm former naval officer. I went to the Naval Academy. I view myself as having such extreme integrity. And I view myself as this honest person. And then in reading your book, it's like, wow, there's so many ways in which I bend myself and fudge the truth to try to, again, unconsciously, to try to make the other person happy rather than just being honest and direct because I don't want to hurt them. I don't want to be, you know, causing them any sort of pain. And the truth is there was a lot of dishonesty inherent in that, even though I viewed myself as a very honest person.
Yeah, I can tell the message of the book sunk in. You get it. Well, and, you know, I was thinking while you were talking about that, you know, again, me having not served in the military, but I've worked with a lot of people who've been in the military, who've been in police departments, who've been fire departments, where they're very hierarchical type systems and where the rules are pretty well spelled out that if you do this, it'll go this way. But I can still imagine situations, for example, with a covert contract, if I do everything right, then I'll have this smooth, predictable world, which, of course, that doesn't exist, even in the military. But I can see, for example, where, like, if you think you've done everything right and followed the rules, then you're expecting certain promotion, and then you don't get it, but this other guy does, and you're going, wait a minute, you know, that dickwad, he doesn't do everything right like I do, but yet he got promoted and I didn't. But maybe he's actually very good at thinking under pressure or actually just stepping up and dealing with things that need to be done rather than following all the rules and trying to get it right. And so maybe he's going to be a better officer material than you are. And so trying to do it all right does not lead to that result of you always getting what you think you should get, but it actually doesn't make you a real effective person necessarily either.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, there's a piece in your book about, and one of the things for listeners that I loved about the book is that it's just peppered with, I don't know, over 30 or 50 different activities and ways to make it very tactical. And I think most listeners love the tactical side of things. And one of the exercises was around like this whole sense of like, if I didn't have to get it right, what would I do? Like just giving myself permission to acknowledge that there's not really these rules and right and wrong. Like it's not like you can do things perfectly. And just by giving myself permission to not do it perfectly, not only have I had a lot more fun at work, but I think I've gotten a lot more done because I'm more open to experimentation and learning and failing. And failure is not some catastrophe anymore. It's just an opportunity to learn. And so that's another benefit, I think, of this is really giving yourself more room to realize there's not this absolute set of rules that have to be adhered to.
Well, there's not. And even if there was, you couldn't do it. And, you know, I tell people my book is not a chronicle of my successes. It's an account of my fuck-ups. It's everything I've done that didn't work, that I've bumbled my way through. And I know one of the greatest compliments that I typically receive from people I work with. In fact, I did a live Q&A with one of my online courses just this weekend. And afterwards, one of the guys in the Q&A wrote me an email thanking me. And he said, thank you for your authenticity and for sharing your own life experiences. It really gives me courage to be imperfect, to stumble and make mistakes and to learn from them. And I always appreciate when people thank me for my authenticity, because 30 years ago, that is not something people would have complimented me on. I was not authentic. I was, you know, licking my finger and holding it up to see which way the wind was blowing and trying to always get it right and never do anything wrong. And not only does that inhibit your ability to really learn from life and to live up to your potential, it also makes it really difficult for people to get close to you and really know you. And one of the things I say in the book is that people are attracted to our rough edges, not how perfect we can seem to be. People relate around each other's rough edges. So, and that's challenging for nice guys. We think we got to be nice and smooth and polished and always have that good front. But that's actually is not what lets people get close to us. It actually keeps them at a distance.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, that whole point of how people are attracted to flawed and authentic people rather than this image of I have everything figured out or the constantly morphing chameleon exercise of trying to blend in or trying to be what people want. And then it's just it's like this emptiness, this vacuousness. I wanted to dive into something else that you said earlier, and I do think for listeners, regardless of whether you're identifying so far as a nice guy or not, I think this is applicable to most people in the military. And this is based on, again, 180 interviews I've done with veterans. It is one of the trends that I've seen, and that is a difficulty that veterans have in advocating for their needs. Many people on the show would consider this selling themselves in an interview or really, you know, going for a job that they want or things like that. So I want to read a quick quote from Robert's book, but he says, and this is on page 93, he says, "When the nice guy puts himself first, there is only one voice to consider, his own. Decisions are now made by one individual rather than by a committee. He no longer has to mind read, predict, or try to please multiple voices with conflicting agendas. When putting himself first, all the information he needs to make a decision is within him. Quote, is this what I want? Yes, then that's what I'll do." And so one of the things that I wanted to, I guess one other context here is I think that most people in the military are conditioned, and it makes perfect sense in the military, they're conditioned to put their unit and their comrades and their ship and everyone and their country before their own self to the extent of giving their life. Like, this is really drilled in deeply to every military member's identity. It's a beautiful thing about those who serve. And I think it can be a liability as they transition to a civilian environment no longer ruled by those rules. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Robert, is why is it important to put one's needs first? And are there any objectives that you see when you tell people to put their needs and how people can overcome those objectives?
Okay.
Objections.
Objections.
Yeah.
This is really at the core of the entire nice guy syndrome and at the book. And I know whenever I tell a nice guy that, you know, they need to put themselves first and start making their needs a priority, you know, when they get that deer in the headlight looks and the butt pucker, like, holy shit, that will make me a bad person. You know, oh no, that will make everybody hate me. That will make me selfish and not good. And I often tell them, okay, when I look up selfish in the dictionary, I want to see your picture. Now, the problem is with most men are pretty black and white by nature. You know, it's kind of is this or is that. And nice guys are especially that way. Either, you know, you're a nice guy, or you're a jerk. Either, you know, you're taking care of everybody else, or you're selfishly only looking out for yourself. And it's easy to go from one extreme to the other. And people kind of often will think, okay, the book's titled No More Mr. Nice Guy. And it's probably something we've all said at one time or another. No more Mr. Nice Guy. I'm not putting up with this. But we also would think, why would somebody write a book teaching men to be not nice? And it's kind of the black and white way that we tend to look at stuff. So here's, to simplify, I give two simple examples. Probably every one of us have flown on an airplane, and we probably have heard this example given before. When they say, okay, in the case of pressure in the cabin, mask will drop down in front of you. If you're flying with a child, decide which child you love the most, put your air mask on first and then put it on your child. And they say, put it on you first, because probably most military people know that, you know, if you're flying at altitude, the higher altitude you have, if you lose cabin pressure, the less amount of time you have before you pass out. And so if you don't take care of you in that situation, you're worthless to the people around you. So put your mask on first, then assist those next to you. Now, those next to you could have already passed out, but you put a mask on them, they're going to get revived. But if you pass out, they passed out, you all die. Okay. So take care of you. And just the simple analogy that I often use is you've got to fill your own bucket up before you can have anything to pour out to give out to other people. And nice guys spend all of their time trying to give from an empty bucket. We're not putting anything into that bucket first in order to have something to give to others. So I love that whole camaraderie, being part of a whole, being part of a group, even be willing to sacrifice yourself for the well-being of that group. But in the military, they still teach you, take care of your gear, take care of your body. You know, they're going to put you in sleep deprived situations, but to train you for it. And but you've still got to take care of you, because if you're broken, you're not a very good fighting machine. You're not a very good teammate. You become the weak link in that hole. So really, you're doing a favor for everybody around you, for your team, for your family, for your loved one, for your kids, if you make you and your needs a priority. And if you don't put you first, who else is going to? Now, it was your mom and dad's job to make your needs a priority when you were a child. You're no longer a child. It's time to grow up. It's your job to make your needs a priority. And I love the quote that you read, because when I talk to people in therapy or in groups or in programs, to me, my definition of an adult is a person who takes full responsibility for getting their needs met. And we can call this integrity, we can call it differentiation, but it is as simple as asking yourself, what do I want? What feels right to me? You know, what is it that most resonates to me as the right thing to do? Now, if you never ask yourself those questions, you don't have any integrity, and you're not a differentiated, i.e., a grown-up person. If you're always just following the rules or second-guessing or trying to please people, there's no you in there. There's no adult. There's no individual. Or if you do ask yourself, what do I want, or what's important to me, or what seems right, but then don't do it, you either give in to the will of others, or your anxiety, or your guilt, or, you know, self-limiting beliefs get in the way, you still have no integrity. You're still not a full-grown, differentiated adult. So there's only one way to grow up. Begin practicing that principle. What do I want? What feels right to me? What am I going to do? And then doing it. Now, you can adjust. You can be open to feedback. You can make a change in plan if necessary, but only make a change in plan when it still feels like the right thing to do. Otherwise, you have no integrity, and nobody can trust you or depend on you.
I love that. I think one of the most powerful phrases in your book was this sense of, I am the only person that has been put on the planet to take care of my needs. You know, my parents have got me covered maybe till I'm 18, but after that, I am 100% responsible for my needs. No one else is. And I think I identify from the nice guy perspective, but I think I also, from the military, my experience was they do such a great job of making sure you know when to get your dental checkup and medical checkup and your pay, and every single thing is taken care of you. And many of the guests I've had on the show, not all of them, but many of them talk about that transition, that mm-hmm. when they were in the military, everything, without them even realizing it, everything was taken care of. And then once they get out, they now have to figure out all of this. They have to figure out personal finances and healthcare and finding a job and where to live. I mean, 1,000 things you never even had to think about before. And so that's why I love what you're saying about needs, because I think that anyone who's in the military right now who's planning to get out, that's something to anticipate and to start building that muscle of taking responsibility for your own needs and realizing no one owes you anything. That was kind of an expectation I think I had when I got out of the military. No one owed me anything, though. I was 100% responsible for myself. And even now that I'm married, my wife has no responsibility for my needs. I need to express them. I need to take care of them. And one of the things that I love, you point this out in your book, but more importantly, I've seen it in my own life, when I start to take care of my own needs, My wife loves it. Like, I think there is this fear that she would resent me for it. And the other day, I went for a long bike ride in the morning, and she was really happy. And I thought that she would be upset that I was not spending time with her. And so I think that's one of the things that came through so powerfully here is there's this apparent conflict of you expect one thing and you actually get the opposite. Like, everyone kind of wins with this approach.
Yeah. You know, a couple of things came to mind as you were talking. One, when you talked about guys getting out of the military and everything's been done for them. And then they're like, oh, you know, how do I do this? And the same thing's true for people getting out of prison. You know, they get out and everything's been done. And there's a term for it that I always mispronounce, but it's like recidivism. And they go out and commit a crime to get put back in jail. Because they know that it's familiar. And I know quite a lot of military people get out, they get lost, maybe start drinking, start wasting time, get, you know, just and then they re-up because, hey, it worked. There was a plan. Everything was taken care of. When you're talking about your relationship with your wife, I wanted to tell a story that's not a military story, but it's a uniform story. And I had a client many years ago. I worked with the woman primarily, but did a couple of sessions with her and her husband. And this woman told me, and she's a very strong woman, she said that when she met her husband, she was a dispatcher at a police department. And her husband was a cop, and he still was at the time I was working with her. And she fell in love with him as a cop. You know, in uniform, taking care of business, having the cop persona, getting stuff done, you know, having a backbone, having his balls. You know, she fell in love with that man. Well, then they got involved, started dating, eventually, you know, moved in, got married. She quit working at the police department. And then she said then when she'd only see him when he'd come home from work, take off his uniform and turn into a different guy. Passively pleasing, trying to make her happy, no real boundaries, no real initiative, no real incentive, no real drive. And she goes, I would have to go on ride-alongs with him to see the man that I fell in love with, because she liked that man in the uniform of how it transformed him and made him a strong, dynamic man. And so I wouldn't be surprised if this doesn't happen with your listeners as well when they make that transition from being in uniform to being in civvies in terms of both maybe on a weekend, but maybe, you know, in terms of leaving the military, that the people that love them, the military persona that's focused, directed, gets things done, is disciplined, maybe boundaried, maybe, you know, and then they come home and take the uniform off, and all of a sudden, what happened to that man? So there are really good qualities in terms of thinking, you know, of what the military and the police does instill about being that part of a team and being strong and being focused and being boundaried and stepping up and doing what's right. And just remember to bring that home with you when you take the uniform off.
I love that. I love that. And you mentioned something that I also wanted to ask about, which was the importance of setting boundaries. And that was something that really hit home for me and has really been helpful in both my personal and professional life. Could you talk about what you mean by setting boundaries and how listeners can practice this?
Yeah, you know, that's such a good question. And it is so core, not just for nice guys, but in life in general. When I do workshops and I bring up boundaries, I'll often kind of quiz the audience and I'll ask them the question, why do children in Western culture get spanked? And I'll go around and I tell them it's a trick question. And you know, people will, you know, okay, I'll give them the volunteer answers. Well, you know, because the parents are angry, wrong. Because the child needs discipline, wrong. You know, because this, because that, because the parents are frustrated. But, you know, no. And I said, wrong, 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 wrong. And I'll finally get to the point of saying, okay, the reason children get spanked is they're not big enough to stop it. That's the only reason children get spanked. Because if you think about it, like I tell people, you know, you may get frustrated with your neighbor, with your coworker, with your partner, with, you know, your CO, but you don't spank them. Why? Because they're big enough to stop it. So what happens fundamentally is for all of us as children, because we were all small and less powerful than seemingly everybody around us, older siblings, neighbors, school teachers, priests, nuns, mom, dad, police officers, you know, we were all small and we never were taught or empowered to create a boundary around ourselves of where we begin and end and where others begin and end. And I often will share the example, you know, I'll ask, since I've worked a lot with guys, I'll say, can you imagine being, you know, let's say, you know, 5, 6 years old and your dad's all mad at you about something and he takes his belt off and he says, get to your room, I'm, you know, give you a lashing. And, you know, and if you could just say, wait a minute, dad, time out, you know, make a little T sign with your hands there. Dad, let's take a time out here. I don't understand what bug you've got up your ass or why you think hitting me with a belt is somehow going to change the situation or ease your frustration or be a positive learning experience for me that's going to actually alter my behavior in the long term. So let's do this, Dad. Tell you what, you go sit in your green recliner chair. You kick back for just a little bit, and I want you just to spend a few moments alone thinking what it is that's really going on with you that makes you think lashing out at me with a belt is somehow going to resolve the problem. I'm going to go up the street and play for a little while. And when I get back, you and I will sit down and have a conversation about what you learned from this experience. Now, we all smile at that because there's no way in hell that would ever happen in anybody's family, because the big people can do what they want to the little people. So what happens is we grow up to be big people. And we still have, remember, this emotional memory stored up in that survival part of our brain that has no clue that boundaries exist, that we can say no, stop, I want to, or enough, or I'm going to take a break, or I'm going to get off the phone now, or I'm going to go for a walk and we'll talk about it when I get back. We don't realize that exists. I learned about boundaries for the very first time. I was in my 30s. I was in my second marriage. I already had a PhD in marriage and family therapy, and I went to a therapist, and I was just beginning to work on what I then came to understand were what I call nice guy issues. And in the very first session, she graphically taught me about boundaries. I had never heard of them. Now, I don't know if this therapist did this with every client, you know, on their first session, or if she could just see I really needed help around boundaries. But they're core in terms of how do we coexist with other people in the world. And I tell people the best example I know of boundaries are like when we drive down a freeway or city streets. All of the speed limit signs, the stop signs, the yield signs, the white stripes, the yellow stripes, the stop lights, all of those are boundaries. And they're what allow a lot of cars to coexist in close proximity at high rates of speeds and hopefully not turn into one major traffic jam or everybody crash into each other. Boundaries allow us to get close and coexist with other people. And as we've talked about, because most of us don't have that concept, we think if we set a boundary, as you said, you think, hon, I'm going to go for a walk, or I'm going to go ride my bike, or I'm going to go to the gym, or I'm going to go spend some time with my buddies, or I'm going to go to a weekend workshop. We think that people are going to be upset at us for that. And maybe they will be. Maybe people, no, I want you to do it my way. I want you to be available when I want you to be available. But to say, no, I'm going to do this, and I'll be back at this time. And, you know, what? And then we proceed from there. But it is the boundaries that let people feel safe around us, is what let them get close to us, is what let us be vulnerable without feeling like we're going to get hurt or smothered or taken advantage of. So, yeah, the boundaries are really crucial in learning how to do this. And I also say in the book, and I've learned from practical experience personally and professionally, when people go from having no clue about boundaries to trying to set them, we become what I call kamikaze boundary setters. You know, when maybe a fly swatter would do to get the job done, we pull out the chainsaw. You know, I'm setting a boundary on this one. You know, maybe we just need to say, okay, stop. Or, you know, a little quieter, please. Or please ask me with a little bit more respect. And, you know, then I'll listen to, you know, so this is normal. It's understandable. But then hopefully we learn that we can learn how to set healthy, loving boundaries that protect us, that make other people feel safe and secure, and hopefully even invite them into their own higher consciousness. Because a lot of times people just aren't aware that they're stepping on our boundaries. We need to let them know.
I love that. I'm not sure if it's your quote or someone else's, but the sense I got from it was, we are responsible for the way that people treat us, or if people treat us in a way that we don't like, it's not that person's problem. It's ours. It's yeah. Really being firm of, I've had so much respect before when I've seen someone, trying to think of the exact scenario, but it was something to the extent of, someone was yelling at them and they're like, I'm not okay with the way you're speaking to me. And the person changed, but it was like, look, they're communicating. This is unacceptable. Or if someone's being called names, like, rather than taking that, like, actually setting that boundary. And I also appreciate, and I can relate to the sense of, it is experimentation. And if you're new to setting boundaries, you're going to make some blunders. And so maybe you overcorrect and set the boundaries really forcefully, but that's part of the learning process. And then you can start to fine tune and communicate it in a way with a little bit more skill. But one of the things I want to point out for listeners is, I do believe the extent to which you really know your values, and that could be personal values, that could be work-life balance issues, or when you really know what your values are, then you can set those boundaries. Because one of my values is I will be home every night before my kids go to bed. And so that's one of my boundaries at work that I'm going to communicate. Mm-hmm. I'll get back online after that, but I'm leaving by 5:30 or whatever that is. And I do want to remind listeners that we just launched the Beyond the Uniform coaching program to connect you with certified coaches at a subsidized rate to help you, as part of this, figure out your values as you transition to a civilian career. But I think that this values work and boundary work go hand in hand of first knowing what your non-negotiables are, knowing what's important to you, the way that you want to be treated, and your personal and professional values. And then I love what Robert talks about in his book and just now is this sense of really being willing to tap in the white picket fence around those values and set some boundaries and learn to communicate them to people, because people won't know implicitly. That was the other quote. It's like we train people the way that we want to be treated. Right. Or something to that extent. It's true. It's like you literally, like, there are people I've worked with where I would never insult them. And there's people that I'll just joke with all the time. And I'm not saying one is right and one is wrong, but it's like those people trained me on how they were willing to be treated.
Yeah. And we really do. And I've said those things and I borrowed them from everybody, from other people, but it's really true. And it's as simple as, for example, maybe, if you're in a relationship and maybe your partner, rather than asking you to load the dishwasher, starts, why didn't you load that? And you can simply say, hey, if you want me to load the dishwasher, ask. You can just be that clear of here's how you do it. But what happens then is often we kind of get into, this back and forth with them. And I call that giving the dog a treat for pissing on the carpet. You don't like a certain behavior that people around you are doing, but rather than either correcting it or setting a boundary or inviting them into higher consciousness, we kind of we'll battle with them. We'll fight about it and we'll go round and round, which just reinforces the behavior, because attention is one of the most powerful reinforcer in all animals, but humans as well. And so learning to set boundaries just changes so much of the fundamental fabric of our life. And it does invite people to engage with us in civil, loving, respectful ways. Because again, a lot of times people don't know they've crossed our boundaries. They're not trying to. They're not being mean-spirited. But we don't let them know. And then sometimes we let it build, and then we have those victim pukes. And they didn't even know. I remember my ex-wife, when I was just learning and working on this nice guy stuff, like, I'd have a victim puke about things she'd been doing that I never set a boundary about. And then when it was all said and done, she'd go, how long has this been bothering you? And I'll go, 6 months, year maybe. And she go, it never crossed your mind to just tell me? I said, That's a good idea. I'll have to try that. Yeah, and it really wouldn't even cross my mind to just say, please don't treat me that way. Or please ask me in this way. Or I'm going to get off the phone now. Call me back when you're in a better mood. Mm-hmm. And that never went over badly. She'd call back in 15 minutes and say, okay, I know what I was so crabby about. But we have to take accountability for that.
I love it. Well, I always like to leave the last question open-ended. And that is, I really appreciate your answering my questions and going through all of this. I'm sure there's things you'd love to share that I didn't ask about. So just want to open it up. Is there anything we didn't cover that you want to leave with listeners?
Man, nothing just comes to mind. We covered some of the really good stuff, the covert contracts, the boundaries, the making your needs a priority. The only really thing that ever comes to mind is one of the things that we forget a lot of time as adults is have fun. Go have fun, you know, make life fun, make your work fun, make your relationships fun. If we're not having fun, we're probably doing something, wrong. We got to, so that'd be just the only piece I'll add. Go have fun.
Well, thank you. And for listeners, Dr. Robert A. Glover, you can find his book, No More Mr. Nice Guy. You can find it online. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Audible. And you can also find more information about him at drglover.com. He does online workshops. He does his own podcast. He has lots of different programs. So I would encourage you to first check out the book. And if that resonates with you, to dive deeper into his work, because he has, you know, he is the world's foremost authority on this topic. He coined the phrase. He's been doing this for over 30 years. And I've seen with him, but anyone who has that much expertise, the level of pattern recognition is so high. So his ability to really get to the heart of matters that are common to so many of us is really extreme. So thank you so much, Robert, for joining me today.
Justin, I loved our conversation. Thank you for the invitation. Hopefully it was helpful to your listeners.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Glover. If you are enjoying the show, two things that would help get the word out is, first of all, leaving a positive review on iTunes. It helps with our ranking. It helps with discovery. Second of all, if you know of other veterans who would benefit from the show, please, please, please share this with them. You can send that to them, their base, their command, whatever way that might get this in front of more members of the armed forces. Thanks so much, and I'll be back with more stories next week with military veterans about their civilian career. Take care.